So my name's Brendan Byrne. I'm a senior consultant with Microsoft Services here in Auckland. I've been with Microsoft for about 8 or 9 years now, I think going on 9. And usually I'm in like a cycle. I do Windows deployment when Windows comes out, and then it kind of fades off, and then server gets released, and then I go do data center stuff. But Windows 10 has been in so much demand that I've been going nonstop for 18 months, and it doesn't look like it's going to end. So question is, there's a lot of people here. Can you raise your hand if you have Windows 10 already implemented throughout the organization? Okay, so there's a few. Come along to my Friday one, from my Friday session, and just make sure that you've got actual Windows 10 and not just a Windows 7 version of Windows 10. And you'll find out more about that on Friday. So the objectives is to really provide you some insight into some of the lesser known technical processes when deploying Windows 10. Prevent you from making some common mistakes, in some instances my mistakes, and I can see some customers that I've worked with here and maybe some of those mistakes, well not mistakes, but you know, learnings, you know. And they're probably up here going, oh, right, see, that was our environment. So, and I really want to fast track your deployment. So if you're in the process of deploying, hopefully these are the little things that you'll be able to learn, that you'll be able to take away and go, oh, yeah, okay, right. Yep, he talked about it that session. Yep, we'll do that. So let's get started. But before I do, this deck, I'm not going to totally talk through the deck. I've actually put a lot of information in the deck, okay? So I'm not going to speak to it. You know, you can glance your eyes over it. I'm just going to pull out certain things and talk about the things that I think are most important about the actual deployment. The reason I've done it this way is often we have an internal conference called TechReady, and that is usually our first source of information. If you can find a good deck on a certain subject, you kind of go to that deck and it's got all the little bits and pieces. All right, so that's what I'm kind of doing with this. It's the kind of one that you can download later and then just go tick through all the things and make sure that you've kind of done that as part of your engagement. So that's the type of approach that I've taken with this. As far as Microsoft Services is concerned, we kind of approach it in these five pillars. So if you look at a desktop deployment, you need to create the image. So we've got image creation. You need to deploy the image. So we call that platform delivery, and also the management of the desktop. Then we've got security foundation, which is everything around securing the device, whether it's group policy, whether it's a number of other things. Then we've got application delivery. So we've built the image, we've deployed the image, now we put the applications down, and then after that, we've got to service it. We've got to keep the patches coming, keep the feature updates coming. So they are the five usual pillars that we use. Now, just through experience over the last few months, I've added these two. So these are not usual ones that we do, but cloud integration is a significant thing that we usually have to discuss with customers. And there's a few tweaks and there's a few things that, you know, aren't in TechNet articles that people want to do. And I'll just share some of those with you and hopefully it'll help you out. And also configuring the UI. I remember Windows 8 that was not the greatest to configure the UI. And now we've got Windows 10. Initially, you know, it was a bit stunted as far as enterprise capability to manage it. But you'll see in just some of the slides that we're going to cover that it's improved significantly. So let's talk about image creation. Now, this is our general recommendations using MDT. You know, you might not use MDT, that's fine. But that's my general recommendations. When I'm with customers, we provide a solution pack which does 90% of the tasks that you might need to build an image. But the one thing that I want to touch on is that one down the bottom around software updates. In the past, we've always made sure that we put the image down, and then as soon as the image is down, then we start applying all the updates, whether it's Office, whether it's Windows, because the delta between, say, Windows 7 SP1 and the current patch level is significant, so you have to get all these patches down. And the same with Office. But now with the fact that the updates for Windows 10 are cumulative, and the fact that when you get that latest update and you apply it to the machine, you have all the patches, and you who came to the Windows servicing session, was it yesterday? Okay, so there's a few people. You would have seen the this is what a customer's machine looks like, and it's, you know, all patchy and stuff like that because there's lots and lots of patches missing, and this is what we test to, you know, as far as when we do our testing, and it's fully patched. Now with the cumulative updates, Windows 10 is always fully updated. It's always at the latest level. If you miss a cumulative update, you know, and for some strange reason, and then the next month you want to apply it, well, you're going to be getting all last month's anyway. So software updates now is, okay, we build it with maybe CBB media, for instance, that is going to have all the latest updates in it. If there's a delta between when CBB is released and when we actually built the image, then we can put it into Config Manager and we can just inject the latest updates. So in most of the implementations that I've done recently, we've actually stripped that out. So no more, you know, WSUS or injecting patches into, or importing patches into MDT or anything like that. We're just relying on the fact that the latest media that's been released is fully patched. One of the key things that most people want to do is remove some of those apps. And be careful. Be careful. So maybe for some of your call center people, maybe you want to remove all the apps. But if you're a mobile worker, and you know, a lot of people that are here will be mobile workers, they'll have their device, they'll use it for personal things, they'll use it for work things. You know, removing all the apps is probably counterintuitive because I probably want to use most of those things. And if, you know, if you're going to restrict those things, then the user experience might be poor for someone that is like a mobile worker. So I've just put some instructions up there. There is a script that you can download, you can configure it, and that will remove just the apps that you want to remove. Some people might have done an in-place upgrade recently from 1511 to 1607 and might have recognized that all those apps that they'd removed actually came back. Now, I believe, I couldn't find the article, but I believe I read somewhere, so don't quote me. Well, actually, there is someone that's probably authoritative in the room that could confirm it. But I believe from 1607 onwards that won't happen. Would that be right? Partially. Okay. It's better than none. So, removing the apps is always one thing that we want to do. What about these? .NET Framework. Now, I don't know if you've done Windows 8. But when you did Windows 8 and you went into MDT and you ticked the little boxes to install the .NET framework, it didn't work. So you had to go through this black magic type of way of getting the .NET framework to install. Now, that is working now in MDT. I'm talking about 2013 Update 2. And that's great. You can tick the box and it installs. However, just in that diagram, you can see... Oh, yeah, I'm looking back over my head... Those two little tick boxes under the .NET framework, by default, when you tick it, those two are ticked as well. Now, how I found out at a customer, and I'm not sure they are here, we ticked that box thinking, yes, it is just going to install .NET, and it actually installed iOS on all the machines. And it was a while before we actually recognized that iOS was on all the machines. Unfortunately, it was at the beginning of the pilots, and someone noticed it, and that was fine. If you go in manually into Programs and Features and just tick that top box, those other two components don't install. So it's only when you're in MDT that does that. So just make sure that you untick those boxes. If you're running anniversary updates, then UEV and AppV, and we'll probably cover UEV in a short period of time, just go into that in a bit more depth, but they're included in the OS now. So in the past, we used to add them as separate applications. Now they're just part of the OS, and we can just turn them on with a bunch of group policy settings. Office. Now, Office, I've always been the one that says Office goes in the image. We always put Office in the image. And there was reasons for that. Usually it's about making sure that, you know, we're reducing deployment times and the likes, and that's fine. In the past, I would always say, okay, MSI, yeah, with 2013. However, with 2016, it's pretty mature. I use it. Do I notice that it's, you know, click to run rather than MSI? No. If I asked you the same question, you probably wouldn't notice the difference either. So the fact that the click to run version is the one that keeps up to date with all the changes, and an application that changes a lot is probably not a good option of putting in the image. Generally, we don't put it in anymore if you're running click to run. There might be other reasons you might do MSI, but at the moment, it's kind of a change. We're kind of seeing that shift. So platform delivery. There's a bunch of things on there around config manager and ADKs and stuff like that and updates that you have to do. That's fine. If you get the deck, there's a whole lot of links in there which take you off to the TechNet articles, so that will help you out. But the key thing that I just want to highlight is while you can use something like Config Manager 2012 R2, you might be able to do most things, but you won't be able to do everything. And really 1606, so getting onto the current branch of Config Manager, so it's not a term that we use, but kind of Config Manager as a service. When you get onto that current branch, if you get to the 1606 version, then while Windows 10 servicing used to work in the past, there were some things that it didn't do well, and you would have some issues, like every single ISO for every single version of Windows 10 downloading to your Config Manager box and then wondering why the machine is not performing as it should. So 1606, it's probably at the point now where all that Windows 10 servicing stuff is actually working well. And if you're Office 365 and you're using Pro Plus, now Config Manager manages the deployment of Office 365 in a much better way than it has in the past. Because the click-to-run version was always something that was quite a hassle to manage. So who's running click-to-run in their organizations at the moment? Okay, so I'm not sure whether you've had, you know, different folders that you need to drop builds in, and some are test and some are pilot and some are production, or do all these other different things in Config Manager. Now it's much more integrated as you get to 1606. So if you're not there, if you're not on the current branch for Config Manager, definitely look at getting onto it. That is the only way you're really going to be at a point where, as new features come out for Windows 10, that you're going to be able to make the most of them. Now, choosing the deployment scenario. So I always go through this. And there's a reason we're going to talk about in-place upgrades. Now, most people go, oh, in-place upgrades. No, we're not going to do in-place upgrades. And there's some nodding heads and the likes. But if you come to the session on Friday, we'll have two customers, one that did it the traditional way and one that did it the in-place upgrade way. And it was significantly different doing it the in-place upgrade way. They still achieved everything that they wanted to achieve, but the actual outcome was significantly different as far as time, effort, and cost was concerned. So, if you're choosing a device, if it's a new device, inevitably you're going to use a custom image. Now, there are other methods. Okay, you might do dynamic provisioning. Now, I'm not going to cover that. I'm just going to cover the more traditional method because that's what a lot of people are still doing these days, not ready to kind of take the jump into the likes of dynamic provisioning. If it's an existing device, then there's a number of considerations that you have to make before you determine whether you have to do a wipe and load or whether you can do something like an in-place upgrade. Now, if none of these considerations actually affect you, then in-place upgrade is what you can do. But if they do, then you're basically restricted to doing a wipe and load. So if you're changing from BIOS to UEFI, then you will have to do a wipe and load. And the main reason is a BIOS machine will have a couple of partitions. If it's UEFI, you've got four or five, I can't remember what it is. But you're going to have to wipe and load to get to repartition those disks. I'll just jump down to the third-party disk encryption. While apparently that's improved with the anniversary build. I've only really had experience with a couple of banks in the 1511 version, and it did cause problems for the in-place upgrade. Operating system. So if you're changing architecture, if you're changing base OS language, which you probably won't do very often, changing domains, if there's a significant configuration drift between what it starts off and what you want it to end up being, then that can be a consideration that might force you to do a wipe and load. If you're going from XP or Vista, which hopefully no one here is, I won't get anyone to put up their hands if they're still on 7, but that would restrict you to wipe and load. You also can't use a custom image. You have to use the media that is downloaded from your volume licensing site. So you can't create a custom image and go, oh, I'm going to use that to do an in-place upgrade. That won't work because the in-place upgrade doesn't know about all your customizations. Also, if you've got a bulk app change, so say you're on Office 2010, and you want to go to 2016, and you've got all these old versions of applications, and as part of the process, you want to get from old to new, then a wipe and load is probably a better approach. While you could do it in an in-place upgrade, you would be doing a lot of, okay, uninstall, reinstall as part of the process, which is probably not an efficient way of doing it. So if none of those affect you as far as what you're planning to do, then you could definitely look at least trialing an in-place upgrade. Put it this way, I did a 3-week POC, and I would, with the customer that I was talking about, I did a little bit of work, went away. He would take the stuff that we did in the lab and he would do it in production. And that went over a period of probably about 9 weeks. By the end of that 9 weeks, they had deployed a considerable amount of their entire environment globally through a self-service in-place upgrade. Okay. The main consideration for them was the fact that, okay, there are some security features that we want, but we don't want it straight away. Yeah, we want to get to Windows 10 as fast as possible. Okay, so they did that, and as far as the security features were concerned, then as they rebuild machines, then they could enable UEFI, for instance. If they wanted to do some other stuff, yes, they could, you know, when a new machine came in, then it would get the actual traditional wipe and load applied to it. So they're just things that you need to take into consideration. So why? Why would you use it? It preserves applications, drivers, data, settings. Now, some drivers you might need to put in a little driver package to implement some new drivers. That may be the case. There may be some applications which aren't compatible with Windows 10, which might need to be uninstalled before doing the in-place upgrade. They're just things that you find out during the in-place upgrade kind of testing process and use Config Manager to work around those things. It is generally faster. The image is generally smaller because you're just using the CBB media, and it's generally more robust. Now, my machine here, I have probably been through, like, as far as in-place upgrades from 10 to 10, you know, it would be ridiculous how many. And I often come in the morning and it says, hi, we've got new, you know, we've done a change on your machine. And then you know that there's a new build that's been put down on your machine. And it happens quite a bit within Microsoft if you're kind of on the fast flighting of the internal releases. There's no ADK dependency, so you don't have to go, okay, right, we're going to make sure this version of ADK is installed everywhere. You could use it to supplement wipe and load. So if you've got Windows 8 and Windows 7, and Windows 8 is quite, you know, it's up to date, it's got all the latest software in it, and it's, you know, as far as configuration, it's kind of where you want it to be, then you could do in-place upgrades for those. And then just your Windows 7, which are old, maybe you haven't touched the image for 3 years, then you could go through and use a wipe and load on those. Either way, it can significantly save on effort and cost to deploy Windows 10. And then, like I said, you might just go back, and when we look at some of the security features, you might just do those at a later stage. Now, user state virtualization. It's not a term that we've used much recently. It was a term that we used a lot within Microsoft back in the Windows 8 and Windows 7 days. But really, it's all about making sure that your user data and your user settings are available no matter kind of what platform you're on. So whether you're going between, you know, Windows 7 and VDI or whatever the case is, that all your settings and data follow you. I just put this in here because things have changed, and there's just some things that I want you to take into consideration when you're thinking about this user state virtualization. So this is traditional. So look at all the tools that we've got. If you want to do user state virtualization, you've got a massive toolkit of about 20 things. Not that much, but roaming profiles. Who's game enough to say they're still doing roaming profiles in this room? Oh, okay. Yes. Roaming profiles isn't designed or won't work well with a modern desktop operating system, mainly because it's all about log off and log on, right? And I don't know how many times I actually do that on my machine. It goes to sleep and I open it up. So when would it actually sync back? So roaming profiles, there might be some scenarios where you use them, but a lot of people are trying to move away from that and looking for alternatives. So let's just scratch that. Personal data. At the moment, most people have it on their H drive. And as far as shared data, team data, it's probably on some network drive somewhere. And if you've got some data which is in those kind of those local this PC folders, then you'll be using folder redirection. A lot of people, that's, you know, this will be consistent across a lot of people here. I'm not going to get hands this time. Then if you're wanting to look after app settings and Windows app settings and OS settings, then if you're not using something like roaming profiles, then you might look at UEV as an alternative. So roaming profiles is tick the box and it just grabs everything and you have to tune it back. UEV is you turn it on and tick some boxes for applications you want and then you kind of tune it out to capture exactly what you want, and it's a very granular. So that's kind of where we are at the moment with a lot of traditional user state virtualization. When we get into modern user state virtualization, it's a bit different. Okay, so in a lot of scenarios that we're working with customers at the moment, UEV is really just used for legacy Win32 apps. So capturing all the registry settings and stuff out of app data. If you are connected to Azure Active Directory, because you're using Office 365 or whatever the case is, then enterprise state roaming is an option that you can use to do the universal Windows apps as well as the OS settings. And as far as articles that I've read internally, this is kind of where we're focusing a lot of our attention on making sure this is something that will be more widely used in future. So those two things can kind of work side by side. So one's kind of doing OS and Windows apps, and the other is doing the old universal, the old legacy apps. Then you've got your team data in the cloud, so that many instances that will be SharePoint. Now other people might have other document management systems. Some will think that's great and they love it. Some will be just jealous that they don't have Office 365 yet, but that's okay. Then we've got OneDrive for Business. I have a lot of people, a lot of the engagements that I'm doing at the moment all have a stream of Office 365 included. So it's not just we're just doing Windows 10, but they also want it cloud integrated and making sure that it works with Office 365. So in that case, a lot of people are wanting to transition from that H drive into OneDrive for Business. If you are doing that, the FTC can help you through that process, just so you know. And then there'll be some folder redirection, possibly. There'll be some folder redirection, and we'll talk about some stuff that people are wanting to do between folder redirection and OneDrive for Business. Now, some people might not want to use enterprise state roaming because it's saving the settings in the cloud. Now, you can control what is saved there, so you could turn off the password button, for instance, so your passwords aren't saved in there. It is saved in Azure, and it is secured with Azure RMS, so it's basically encrypted when it's in the cloud. If you decide, because security says, no, okay, we can't do that, then you can use UEV as it can be used, and it will cover all three of those scenarios. So with the customers that we're working with, knowing that this is where kind of Microsoft's heading with the enterprise state roaming, a lot of them are choosing to actually choose to use enterprise state roaming and just use UEV as the Win32 apps. And so far, it's worked well. Now, application delivery. There's a lot of things that I could talk about application delivery, user-targeted installations, the new software center, et cetera, et cetera. But really, as far as your engagements are concerned, there's one thing that I really want to touch on, right? And that's application compatibility, because this could be the thing that syncs your Windows, your efficient, quick Windows 10 deployment. A lot of people in here, how many have done XP to 7 or XP to 8 migrations? Okay, a lot of people. Right, In the past, when that has happened and you've talked about application compatibility, this was the process. Discover all the apps. Once you've discovered all the apps, rationalize them down to a bunch of known apps that we're going to support. Once we've done that, then we're going to assign an owner and a tester for each of those applications. They're going to run through rigorous testing to make sure that those applications work. And when they are rubber stamped, then we're going to go, yes, all ready to go with our Windows 7 deployment. And a lot of organizations, the larger they get, that was a significant part of the actual engagement. You know, just application compatibility. We can get everything as far as the platform, you know, config manager and building the image and deploying the apps. It's all ready. We're just waiting for application compatibility to finish. So it's a key thing. So can we sustain that if we go to Windows as a service? Because there's a chance that a feature update, now you would hope it wouldn't, because it goes through this kind of process to make sure that a lot of people have tested it, you know, all those consumer people out there have tested things, and the Windows Insider program have tested things, so you would hope that things would just work when it gets to us. But there is always the possibility that it could break something. And that thing that it could break could be your critical line of business application, okay, which would be a bit of a disaster. So we really have to still take into consideration application compatibility testing, but we need to take a new approach. So it's this risk-based application compatibility. It's about balancing the risks, because we know that everything can't be tested. You know, if we're bringing out feature updates once, twice, or three times a year from our internal presentations, which we deliver, it used to be, you know, two or three, now it's gone down to two, so I don't know what the final is. But, you know, even if they're coming twice a year, that's two opportunities that it could affect some of your applications. So what do we do? We adopt this, and the reason we adopt it is because we're going to concentrate on those critical line of business apps, okay? It fits in with the rhythm of change. Now, rhythm is one of the key words that we use with Windows as a service, because you have to get into a rhythm. And I've got a slide which will talk about that in a bit more detail coming up. If you don't get into the rhythm and you just go, oh yeah, I've got Windows 10 in, and then you wait and you kind of get to the end of a branch, yes, it could be an interesting time for you. And it will be another, you know, XP to Windows 7 in the last 3 months type scenario. Key thing around this is discovering potential issues as early as possible, and trying to reduce the time and efficiency and costs that are all related to that. I'll probably talk about this in a bit more depth when we get into Windows as a Service. So you've got an application portfolio. Now, I don't know how many of you actually have some kind of system which says these are all the applications that we've got. Okay, if you don't, then it's probably something that you want to take into consideration. Because the first thing you want to do is you want to assess them. You want to go, okay, as far as these apps are concerned, what bucket do they fall in? You know, is there financial or business impact if this application stops working? Then if the answer is yes, then you would class a critical line of business app, okay? And we'll look at how we would test those in a second. Then you've got supported apps. So it provides value to the business, but if it didn't work, it would be more of a bit of a productivity hit, more than financial impact. Okay, so you've got that. You've got unsupported applications. So that's where new version, this is an old version, we're not supporting it. Or you've got all these apps, you know, sneaking into the environment because it's something like Chrome and it installs in your user profile. Or you're using SaaS applications and anyone can go out and, you know, sign up to Slack or whatever the case is. So they might not be introduced by IT, but they are in the environment. Then you've got unwanted applications. It's either unlicensed, you know, the amount of people that use Google Earth in a business situation and aren't actually licensed for it. You know, so it's an unlicensed application, or it's just banned by IT. You know, we don't use that. So you've got all your applications. First thing is to get them into these buckets. Based on the buckets, then we go, okay, how are we going to test them? So if they're those core line of business apps, the first thing we're going to do is we are going to make sure that they have the owners, they have the testers, and they have some kind of testing process to test those apps. Okay, if you've got 300 apps, you would hope that that critical line of business is no more than 10%. Okay? And if you are in a situation where you automate application testing, that is fantastic. I've got one customer that I'm working with at the moment. Most of their critical ones are all automated, so they're not even worrying about it. It's just like, okay, we'll just run the automation. That's our first test. So that's 10%. Say it's 10%. That's where we do the rigorous testing. Yes, we still have to go through that process, but you have people that are assigned to do that, and they know it's going to happen. They have to do it twice a year, and they run through that test, they get it signed off, and then we can kind of go on to the next phase. When we get to the supported apps, those ones that, you know, make up the 270, now there might be, say, 150 people that could cover those 270 apps, you know, as far as application users who could be testers. So we test them in more of a BAU type scenario. So current branch for business comes out, and then the first group gets it, and I will go through this in a bit more depth, and they just test it in their everyday work scenarios. The other ones, you know, if it's unsupported, then it's just reactive. Then if it's unwanted, then you might go to the point of using AppLocker to prevent people using it. But the main two is that's in the proactive one, where your critical line of business apps are fully tested and all the rest are just tested via BAU. Now you might have scenarios where one particular app, it's always causing us problems. You might put that into the critical line of business apps just because you know it's probably going to cause you problems, right? So there might be situations where that doesn't hold true, but that's something you can look into. Now, I'm just noting this. There is a cloud service that we're providing at present. Works through the operations manager suite, so upgrade analytics, it's in preview, and it uses Windows telemetry data to start actually gathering information about the machines. So anything around the applications, the usage of the applications, the devices, device driver inventory, all these things. So you can start getting information about the machines, but beyond that, it works with things like the Microsoft compatibility data that we basically store. So if there's an issue with an application, Upgrade Analytics is going to know about that, and then if you've got that application in your environment and it's been scanned on a machine and it's come back into your portal, we're going to show you that there's a known issue. So I haven't actually had a chance to work on this, so I've got just so many projects on at the same time that I would love to have a go, but I just haven't at this stage, but I encourage you to go out there and look at the preview. And this could be something that you could use going forward as well. It's not just something that you use for the upgrade, it's something that you can use ongoing. And it's probably the first time that we can say, actually, here's some value to that telemetry data that we're collecting. So don't turn it off. Okay, servicing. This is what we're used to, okay? We're used to, monthly update release, patch Tuesday. Yeah, it's not really Tuesday for us. And don't use Wednesday, because if Tuesday falls on the 31st, then you'll miss a week, and then you won't get patches for that month, so probably the 15th is the best day for us as far as patches are concerned. But you would go through some patch cab, so it's like, oh, do we want that, do we not want that? And you'd go through and you'd strip half of them out, and you just end up with a portion of them. And my application compatibility might have been a reason for that, but at some stage you're going to have a very out-of-date image, and on top of that, I lost it. It's just like, it's the end of the day. So it might come back to me, but anyway. Now this is a diagram that I use just to kind of help you understand this Windows 10 servicing as far as the plans are concerned. So how many people here have Config Manager in their environments? Okay. So how many people don't have Config Manager in your environments? Okay. How is Windows 10 servicing going for you at this stage? It would be interesting to find out. I'm an Alteris person from way back. I had an option of Alteris or Microsoft. I happened to go to Microsoft, and at this stage, it looked like a good choice. But we have these servicing plans. So we create these servicing plans, and these servicing plans are made to upgrade us from one branch to the next. So just taking this as an example, a rough example of 1511 to 1607, and how this might work in your environment and how you might get in the rhythm. Usually I do this with a kind of a whiteboard, so I'm kind of right up there, and yeah, I can't do that here, so hopefully it will go okay. So 1511, there is this servicing branch that's out, and we release to the public the Windows Insider preview of it. At that point, most people think, oh, it's Windows Insider preview, right? Okay, we're not going to touch it. But most organizations actually look at going, okay, right, there are going to be some scenarios where we will have people testing on the Insider preview. Now, that might be a small number of people in IT that just want to know what's happening with the desktop, you know, the UI is changing, so we just want to be on top of that. Is it going to cause all our users not to be able to use Windows 10 again, or whatever the case is? Or your developers, they might want to start looking at, okay, there's this new architecture inside there, and we need to start, you know, designing our apps around it. We want to have a play. So there are scenarios where Windows Insider program might be in your organization. It's probably something where they're managing it themselves. It might be in an isolated environment. It usually is on a secondary PC or a VM, but we encourage you to kind of dabble as soon as it comes out so you know what's coming. Then 1511 is made CB, right? And the media comes out, and then we start on this path of current branch, okay? And that's the branch that goes to the consumer, you know, the Harvey Norman PC that you've got at home, you know, that's going to get updated with current branch. Now, we need to make sure that current branch is actually in the environment. Now, you could ignore this, okay? That's fine. If you want to ignore it, why we do it, though, is we want to make sure that we test those critical line of business apps as close as possible to the start of that branch as possible, right? If we wait until CBB to start testing those, all of a sudden the amount of time that branch is going to be supported for is less and less, and that means less and less time that we're going to have to fix any issues. So the first ring that we've got, so I've got two rings here. With most customers that we're working with at present, we have five rings, okay? So that's like a five-phase deployment. You could do less, okay? I'll just go through why we do it this way. And what we've said to customers is if it seems like it's going okay and things aren't just turning to custard, then you might be able to just absorb a bit more risk and cut the amount of phases. But that first ring is critical app testers, okay? So those ones that we said are managed app, they're the critical line of business. They're in the first phase, so we might have a delay of maybe a week after CB is released, and then we'll go and deploy that to, say, their secondary PCs or their virtual machines, okay? And then they can run their test processes, they can do their smoke tests or whatever kind of testing they want to do, just to make sure, yes, we're kind of happy that if we go and do it to the next group, which is CB Ring B, that it's not going to turn to custard on them. Right, so the initial test is just to make sure, yeah, we're kind of happy. The second one is, yeah, okay, we're going to now put it out to our critical line of business app testers. And it's a larger group, and at that stage, you might be comfortable to actually send it to their primary devices. So if that's all okay, that's fine. You just wait for CBB to come out, and then you get on to the next phase. If there's an issue, okay, then you make sure that you start resolving the issue straight away. Okay, and that might mean that you have to talk to your, you know, your Microsoft representative, your TAM, if you've got Premier, to say, hey, we've got this issue. We need to somehow get it resolved, and then maybe they can help you through that process. But you want to do that as close to that end as possible, right? If you leave it and just go, oh, you know, we'll leave it, you know, it's like a railway track, right? And that railway track is in New Zealand, and it's up in Kaitaia or something, and at some stage it's going to come to an end, okay? And you're on a bullet train kind of heading towards it. You want to make sure that, you know, you're not getting right towards the end of the track where you have to actually get to the next branch. Not that there's going to be any train wrecks with Windows 10 servicing, but you kind of get the idea. So we've got the concept of feature updates and quality updates. So quality updates are just those normal software updates that we've had every month, and it's all around quality and security. So they're going to come every month. Okay, and I'm pretty sure that with the current branch for 1511, it was more than 4 months. We usually say 4 months. I think it was actually 5 months, just based on the websites that I looked at. And then we say, okay, it's gone current branch for business. And at that stage, current branch for business media comes out, and current branch for business media is current branch plus all the quality updates that have been released so far. So you get new media with everything incorporated. When that happens, now we're in this kind of current branch for business phase, okay, and we have another set of tests here. This is where we get into our pilot app testers, our BAU testing. Okay, so the first group is that maybe that group of 120 that cover the 270 apps or whatever the case is, and they just start using it as required, and if there's any issues, then they'll go through a special process to get back to the application team to make sure everything's working. That's on a primary device. Once that kind of works, then you broaden the group, okay? And at some stage, you're going to go, yes, this is working. Then you're going to press the big red button, and it's going to go to everyone else in the organization, and you'll be confident. Again, you need to make sure that it's as close to this end as possible, okay, to give yourself as much breathing space as far as that's concerned. You have all the quality updates that are still going to come down during that period. At some stage, there is, when we bring out a certain number of current branch for business, you know, in production, at some stage that current branch for business will become end of support. And then you get a grace period to kind of, you know, give you a bit of extra time to get to the other branch. And then, yes, we're not going to be creating the patches for it. Or security updates, all those quality updates for it. In the meantime, this isn't a linear type thing where, you know, you get through all the testing and then, okay, we start again. And I haven't drawn it in this because I just did it just before I came up. It was kind of last minute. But you're going to have those same testers starting and going exactly the same time. Say, for instance, your Windows Insider people might be testing at the same time as your current branch people. So you have multiple tests going on at the same time. But it's important to get in that rhythm and give yourself as much breathing space as possible. So in the off chance that something happens, then you've got time to sort it out rather than kind of giving yourself not much time and then possibly having issues. As far as preparation, now I'm not going to go through and look at the servicing plan and go, okay, this is how you create the servicing plan. I think there was a demo yesterday and there's plenty of stuff on the internet which tells you how to go through it. You just got to make sure you know how to create the filter properly. That's probably the biggest thing that you need to know. But as far as preparation, you need that prioritized list. You need to be able to put it in those different buckets. Then you need to have the application testers and owners assigned to it. Okay, and then you need to know what their devices are because you're going to have to add them to the collection. So you need to know these relationships if you want to go through a testing process like this. But you also need communications, a communication plan, and a support plan. So as far as communications are concerned, you need to let them know that, okay, yes, a new branch has come down and you're going to get it in the next week. And if there are any issues, remember that we've got the special support process to take you through to the appropriate people. And that's the main thing. You need to make sure that it doesn't go through to the standard service desk and they go, oh, I can't fix it, and then they, oh, I'll rebuild your machine, okay? In this instance, if they're testers and they've just had a feature update, then it needs to go through to a group that are looking at the applications. So that's just what that's showing. I'm not going to spend too much time in security in this session. I'm going to spend more time in security in the other session, mainly because not many people focus on, in their current Windows 10 deployments, don't really focus much on the security components of Windows 10. But there are some things that I want to pull out. Credential Guard is low-hanging fruit. Okay, and it is to prevent those pass the hash and pass the ticket attacks. And it's really about taking those logon services where when you logged onto your machine, your password hash would get stored in kernel memory, and then someone could put just a little utility, if they can get it past the antivirus, which, you know, I tried and it's causing me all kinds of problems. But you get it on there, and then you can run it, and you can grab their hash, and you can inject it into your hash, and then whatever rights they had, you have rights to. So if they were a domain controller, they wouldn't be a domain controller. If they were a domain admin, then they would have access to whatever you had access to as a domain admin. So it is low-hanging fruit, okay? Recommendation is put it as part of the image. So you can enable Hyper-V, and that enables most of the settings. There's a registry setting you can enable as well, and then it is ready to go, providing you have some hardware support as far as virtualization extensions, etc. So it is low-hanging fruit. Now, it might break things. I've had a couple of customers where they've had some applications which may be using unsecure NTLM-type communications, and it broke those things. So it actually it raised the issue, and then they actually got their partner in. They, oh, okay, right, actually we need to fix that. And they fixed it, and then they turned it back on. So you do need to be able to turn it off and on, and that can be done by group policy. So the things that we do in the image is purely just to get it to the point of you know, being able to control it via group policy. Things like smart screen and user account control, yes, we use those. BitLocker, yeah, we, you know, these are just things that we do. Things like Windows Hello for Business. There's Windows Hello, which is the biometrics, and there's Windows Hello for Business, which is more the old Microsoft Passport, which is the asynchronous key pair or certificate-based kind of authentication between your device and a service, you know, what we're doing to get rid of passwords. Now, that, in the past, has required server 2016 domain controllers, so none of the customers that I've worked with actually use it. But, you know, come to the other session, it might be something that you have on the horizon as far as the security components are concerned. Also, Windows Information Protection, that's now available to be managed through Config Manager, so it's actually Config Manager that manages it. But just take the scenario. You copy some corporate data out of Exchange, or you copy it out of SharePoint, and you copy it down to your downloads folder. With Windows Information Protection, if it's set up, then that is now encrypted as your business's corporate data. Now, if I go move it from my documents folder and put it onto a USB key, encryption remains with it. If I go and put it into my personal OneDrive and try share it, yeah, they might still get the sharing link, but when they try open it, they don't have, you know, they're not a Microsoft employee, they're not going to get access to it. So if you're at the point where you've got Config Manager 1606, then Windows Information Protection should definitely be something on the horizon for you. AppLocker is good if you follow some of the NSA guidance. So if you look up AppLocker and NSA, they have a whole lot of guidance there, and it makes it a whole lot more friendly to actually use in the environment. Device Guard is not something that you just turn on, otherwise everything will just stop working. You have to sign the apps, and it's really just like, okay, I've got an Android phone, everything's trusted. Okay, I've got an iOS phone, everything has to be signed. It's pretty much exactly that scenario, but on the Windows 10 PC. If you did choose to go down that path, then the playbook that hackers use for, you know, malware and, you know, getting little bits of software on your machine to prompt you for user account credentials, and then they cryptolocker things and stuff like that, all that disappears because that malware won't be signed, so it has no chance of running, and then playbooks get thrown out and they have to come up with new ideas to secure your devices. So I'm just kind of covering that blue one. There's a whole lot of other stuff on that that kind of makes up the entire stack, but we'll probably cover that more on Friday. Be aware that your hardware might not support some of the new stuff. Okay, so while you might go, oh yes, I want to do that, there might be some hardware which is slightly older which may not be able to run it. So just take that into consideration, you know, when you're kind of planning your engagements. And usually we start off by understanding what the hardware is out there, and then based on that, we'll actually start determining, okay, yes, we can support those features or not. Group policy. If you're going from like 7 or something like that, and you've got to make some new Windows 10 policies, just use this one word, justify, okay? If you're going to take something across, and I'm in your engagement and I look at it, I'm going to go justify the fact that you're taking this across. Don't bring legacy stuff across unless you really have to. You want to keep it as streamlined as possible. If you've got people that are going to go between Windows 7 or 8 or 10 type scenarios and you don't want to give them additional accounts, then probably the only thing you can do as far as their users are concerned is create WMI filters for those group policies. We've actually been working with customers around changing their OU structure because a lot have had Windows 7 and Windows 8 OUs and Windows 10 OUs. Now we're kind of changing that back and going, okay, right, we've got a current branch one and we've got a current branch for business and we've got legacy because you might still have some of those old 7 machines out there. And the reason being is current branch for business gets the Windows 10 policy. The current branch for business gets the Windows 10 policy. The current branch one gets the Windows 10 policy plus a testing one. So new group policies come down, that means you can start testing it. Like, say, if you wanted to turn on Credential Guard, for instance, if it wasn't in the previous version, then you could put it in there and you could test it against your current branch machines. This is not we just work in whatever works best for the customer, but this is something that we're looking at. One thing on BitLocker, a couple of things on BitLocker, there is a pre-boot recovery message. So if you're using MBAM, you can put a group policy in there and it will say, go off to this URL, you know, because they get their drive locked and it's like, oh, what do I do? You know, they ring up the help desk when they could have just gone off to a portal and did it themselves. If you don't have MBAM, then you could put, you know, ring the help desk on this number, you know, just to help and say, oh, you know, I need my BitLocker key recovered. So there's something in there that can help you. Encrypt user space only can save you a significant amount of time and user impact. If you've got a 500 gig machine and it's trying to encrypt, that will affect the user. If it's only 30 gig, because that's the size of the OS, that is not going to impact the user. It's probably going to be encrypted by the time the user gets it. So definitely an option that you should turn on. And if you can, if you're using UEFI and you've got secure boot on the machines, then you can get rid of pins. So as far as people using PIN in the auditorium, is anyone still using PINs? Yep, so PINs, not many, that's good. So PINs are, users hate PINs, right? It's just another thing that we've got to remember. And just the way secure boot works, it means that it negates the attack that people use to try steal the BitLocker key while the machine is booting up. I won't go into any detail there though. So, cloud integration. This is where it usually gets interesting, because it's quite new, and some people want to, you know, test the boundaries. And I've got one slide which I've actually I've hidden because user state migration and OneDrive for Business is an interesting concept. It kind of works, and I won't go into any detail, but you know, some things can cause you more of a nightmare than actually helping out. First thing. Do you want seamless cloud access? So do you want Windows Store for Business pre-configured with your work accounts? Do you want your work accounts to be added automatically to your machine? Do you want single sign-on to Azure and Office 365? Do you want enterprise state roaming in the cloud? A lot of customers still, if they want that kind of that access, they go in and they add their work accounts. Okay? So you can get around that by using an Azure Active Directory register with an AD join. And I've just got some brief details. Yes, you need Azure AD Connect. Usually it's a later version rather than older version. There's a group policy that you set, and then there's a couple of things around service connection points. And if you're using ADFS, there's a couple of claim rules that you apply. As soon as you turn those things on, in all the instances of all the customers that I've worked with, then you go into the store and your work account's there. You go in where your work accounts usually show under your account settings and they're all there. So definitely if you're looking at cloud integration, that is one of the key things that you need to turn on. Now, OneDrive for Business is usually a key topic. Some of the things that we're talking about here are in preview and they'll be coming soon, but we'll talk about them now. A lot of customers go, okay, can users share externally? So you can manage that with a big hammer at the moment with old versions of SharePoint, OneDrive for Business. can you limit the domains that they can externally share to? So maybe, yes, we don't want it to be open slather. We just want to target, you know, these partners because we do a lot of sharing with them. Do I want to be able to sync to non-domain join devices? So I put a whole lot of corporate data into my OneDrive for Business, and then I go home to my home PC, and I go to the Office 365 site, and it goes, oh, are you who you say you are? And then my MFA comes up, and I say, yes, I am. And then I click sync, and all that corporate data goes on my home PC, and then I have a copy of that data. Right, so these type of settings are settings that you need to consider because you could be opening yourself up to all kinds of issues around controlling your data and data leakage. Also, the amount of data, you know, 1 terabyte, thanks Microsoft, you've given me 1 terabyte. Do you want every one of your users to have 1 terabyte of OneDrive for Business storage? At the moment, with the limitations of the client, no. In future, with a few things that are on the horizon, may not matter, but they're providing storage at storage quota at the user level very soon. The next gen client, so there is a new client. If you've got the anniversary build, it comes with the anniversary build. It's kind of you know, those virus type applications that install into your local profile. OneDrive for Business, or the OneDrive next gen client, is like that. There's reasons, and I can understand the reasons, but we usually, you know, when we talk about Google Chrome and the fact that it could do it, it's like, oh, Google Chrome and stuff like that, but, you know, we do it ourselves. Auto updates, and it's the same client for OneDrive Personal as OneDrive for Business, so it's not like you have to go and have two clients. Some limitations, if you go, oh, I want to protect my data, so I'm going to use RMS. As soon as you turn on RMS for SharePoint or OneDrive for Business, then the next-gen client won't sync it. It will actually come up with a message saying, no, sorry, you can't sync it. Also, at present, there's a preview version of the next-gen client, and that will sync SharePoint sites, those team sites. Right at this point in time, if you've got the current GA version, then it will do your OneDrive and your OneDrive for Business, but it will not do your SharePoint sites. The only option that you've got is going and getting your old Office 2013 version of OneDrive for Business and just installing that and then using that to sync your OneDrive for your SharePoint sites. But I think that's pretty close. That diagram there is just a screenshot of it. I'm running it on my machine. It seems to be working great, but it's just not released yet in preview. If you want to know what's coming out with OneDrive for Business, there's a link there. It takes you to an Ignite session in the US, and it goes through the roadmap of what's happening with OneDrive for Business. They're actually bringing some of the things back that they took out, which caused a bit of strife when they did, so that's looking promising. As far as configuring it, there is an ADMX file that you have to download. Now, this is not like a normal ADMX download that you do. You download it, and then you open up the XML, then you edit it yourself. So it's not something that we usually do I haven't done it since like Terminal Server 4 days, where we kind of created our own ADM files and stuff. But you do have to do that. There's some stuff that you have to add in, then you put it in your central store, and then you configure the OneDrive for Business client. What I want to touch on, because we're just about at the end of time, is folder redirection. So there's a lot of customers that go, oh, okay, right, I've got OneDrive for Business, but I've got this PC. You know, everyone's seen in Windows 10, you've got this PC and it's got documents. Oh, there's a picture there. Documents and downloads and everything like that. And it's like, oh, but if they save in there, what happens if I rebuild their machine? So this is based on a support article in Office. It's not a TechNet one. It's not something that we say, oh, yes, do this. But if you go to the article down the bottom, it does say, hey, if you want to do this, this is how you do it. And it's all about... before we jump there, there are some good candidates. So your documents might be a good candidate, your pictures might be a good candidate, downloads probably isn't, because you might have ISOs and stuff in there. It could just, you know, cause your OneDrive for Business to be syncing, you know, 100% of the time. My music's folder, I was going to put my music in there, but no, I have a streaming service and the application caches all the offline stuff in my music folder. So that means I'm taking stuff off the cloud, putting it into a local cache, and then I'm going and putting it back into the cloud. Clients in future will be able to get around that, but for the time being, not a good one. And really what you're doing is you need the ADMX file, you need to use the default syncing location, and then you need to make this variable. It's like a OneDrive sync variable, and then you use that in your folder redirection. And the reason you do that, if you don't put it in there and that folder doesn't exist because the user hasn't run through the wizard, because you still have to run through the wizard to set up the OneDrive client, what happens is folder redirection will create the folder, and then OneDrive for Business will, they might run through the wizard, the folder's already there, so it'll create another folder. Okay, so it's the folder redirection then breaks. So just check out that article. It doesn't take much to set up. Really, the only hard part is just setting up that environment variable. Now, it is past 4:15. I'm just going to run through these next slides. It's more just a guide for you guys to understand that, okay, as far as the UI is concerned, there are some things that we can do. So that traditional start menu, the all apps. Now, when I tested it on my machine, I did it on a 1511. When I tested it on 1607, it didn't work how it did in 1511, so I've got to figure out why. But on 1511, you could just go into these locations, and you could add a folder and icons, and then they would show up in your start menu. Customers that have start menus where it's like all programs, and then it's our apps, and then under that, they have a folder for each of the apps, and then that's where the links are. How this would work, it would consolidate just so it's one level. So when you go into all apps, you only ever click on a folder and you see all of the icons of all the levels below it. So if you've got 3 or 4 levels, when you go into all apps, you click that one folder and you will see all the icons from all the levels underneath it. So for customers that might have gone and separated them by folders, and you know this is our organization's app folder, and then have all those separate folders, it did mean they had to do some reconfiguration of some of their packages. Customizing the start screen, it's just an XML file to export it once you've kind of done your configuration. And we can set a default start screen by dropping that file into a specific location. We can enforce it, say for a call center, we can enforce it via group policy. We also have a partial start screen. Now, that was in 1511, and I demoed it to a customer. I said, this is how you manage this section of the start screen. And then all of a sudden, it broke. I haven't tested on 1607, so hopefully it still works on 1607. But if you want an area in that start menu where IT can centrally control it, then the partial start screen is what you do. And I missed that partial start screen there. Also now we can do stuff with the taskbar. So 1511 and an unattend file, for me, it would not work if I wanted to add things to the taskbar. Also in 1511, you couldn't remove Edge. And you could remove Edge, but you had to take like a big snapshot of the registry, and then you had to apply it to the machine, and then you would have to have a script which killed Explorer a couple of times, and it would flash because you know Explorer was dying, and then finally Edge was gone. Fortunately now you don't have to go through that. You can just use this taskbar configuration, and you just add it to the rest of your layout modification XML. Some other tweaks, yes, there's a folder that you can, you know, replace user logon files. If you want to change the theme color to a different accent, you have to go in and use a hex editor or change the hex of the theme. Lock screen, logon screen, so you've got lock screen, so that's the one that's usually there when you walk up to your machine, then you swipe it up or click a button, and then you get the logon screen. Now they're actually one. So you don't have to worry about, you know, putting up your lock screen, then you've got the Windows screen behind, or maybe you've just turned it into a plain color. One thing to take into consideration is that if you have a very busy lock screen in the middle, then you're going to swipe up, and then all your logon details and all the details that are in that logon screen are going to be overlaid on that busy background, okay, and it can be quite an eyesore. So you want to kind of keep it kind of clean in the middle. And if you want to turn off those consumer features, then there's a group policy for that. Now, if you download the deck, there are some hidden slides for a whole lot of other stuff that might be helpful. So hopefully that has been informative. Thank you very much for your time.
All right, we're back. It is the wrap-up show, my friend. How are you doing?
I love how you just transitioned into that. It's a beautiful, smooth transition.
Thank you. I've been doing this for nearly a year or two.
You are professional, my
friend. Thank you. Thank
you.
I have been, like I said, my mom thinks I'm really good at this stuff. She tells me all the time. Before we get into the wrap-up, we were having a little discussion about purchasing.
A debate.
It was a discussion.
Okay.
It was lively. But you said that I have to purchase an All Blacks jersey.
You cannot leave Auckland without an All Blacks jersey.
It feels a little spendy.
No, not at all. It's worth it. It has the magical pixie dust that is the All Blacks essence inside.
You're saying people will look at me and say, something's going on with that dude.
Absolutely.
That jersey is magical.
And then when you get on the plane to fly back, you could instantaneously break into the haka.
Upgraded.
Right there. And
just do the haka. That's how you start it, right?
You could.
That's about all I know.
Yeah,
and so
that's all I'd ask you to do right now.
He's telling. Okay, don't do it. So he's telling me to go down the street, purchase one. I may or may not do it. I guess we'll find out.
You got it, man.
Tomorrow. Okay.
Maybe you should do it tonight so you could wear it tomorrow.
Oh.
There you go. On air. Wear it on air.
Well, I don't promote brands. I mean, just the Gap, apparently, because it's nondescript. We've had a full day today.
Yeah, man.
Let's go.
You were rocking the stage down here today.
So were you. We've had a couple of things. Let's talk about some of the interesting sessions that went on for me. Azure Machine Learning with Jennifer Marsman was fantastic. I thought it was good. You should check it out. Hopefully it goes up soon. Anything in there for you? Because there was a lot of gobbledygook IT type stuff that I was just like, yeah.
I had a lot of good time talking with Daniel at the very end there for the interview I did with him. Talking about transitioning from his roles from being a consultant and leading a practice just around the public cloud environment, and then now actually taking a whole company forward into this hyperscale cloud stuff that is very transformational.
Somebody told me that there is a culture change when you move, for IT pros, when you move from in-house IT stuff to cloud-based IT stuff. Is it a tough culture change?
It's definitely very noticeable. I mean, it's something I've been grappling with the last couple of years. But
have you lost any hair over it, though? I mean,
I don't want. I still have a full head of hair, a full. Massive afro.
Sure, it's just, tucking it into that hat. It's coming out the little rings on the side. I'm just telling you.
But the biggest thing, honestly, for me was just IT pros by nature troubleshoot and try to figure stuff out and fix it, right? We're fixers for a lot of the stuff that we do,
right?
The role that we have. And a lot of the stuff you do with the cloud ends up being an environment where, you don't need to fix it. You can just nuke it and then bring it back again and have it going again fast. If you spend more time troubleshooting, you're spending less time getting the rest of stuff up and running.
So what do you do with the rest of your time? Do you pick up gardening or something? I don't know what.
Yes, I'm actually, it's a Japanese bonsai tree.
Oh, he's like Mr. Miyagi.
It grows very slowly, and it's one tiny little clipping to make it grow in the right direction.
That's awesome.
It's what you don't take off is what makes it happen.
I see. So that's kind of a cool thing. Definitely watch that. I had a couple of interviews that were interesting. Donovan Brown, obviously, Mr. DevOps, was here.
How could you not be interested in that?
We didn't have a lot of time, and so we literally packaged up sort of the whole people process product, but sort of dive into what that actually means.
Yep.
Instead of saying, just open the DevOps jar and spread the jam all over your servers, he actually went through and told us what that meant.
Because I was about to say, you probably would think of actually spreading the jam on servers.
Yeah, that was what literally I thought.
He's looking for the DevOps jam
someplace. I mean, it says it right here on the paper. And then obviously we had Donna Sarkar with one of the Windows Insiders.
What was that like?
It was pretty cool because Windows Insiders are sort of a rabid community of people that came on and literally started asking all the questions. It was fantastic.
You heard this first. The Windows Insiders.
Rabid.
Rabid.
And I love it. Rabid is fantastic. And she talked about Windows Insiders. She talked about Insiders for Good. She talked about the community and the events that they do. It was fantastical. And you, sir, I believe you have some talks tomorrow.
Tomorrow I've got a couple talks lined up in case you're interested. You know, the thousands of people watching online.
Sure.
None of mine are live streamed. You've got to be there in person to be able to see them. I'm doing them inside NZ2 right over there. And it's going to be about Azure Container Service and also about the underlying services known as Azure Scale Sets. But I made sure people knew that I'm doing this from an IT pro and infrastructure perspective.
I see.
Not necessarily from a developer perspective.
So I wouldn't care.
So it's good stuff that's there.
Right.
So we're being warned that they're going to throw stuff at us here in a minute. Here. He's warming up his cricket arm right now.
All right, for tomorrow we have tons of good things. So is that the only talk? There's another one, right?
Well, there's two.
Let's tell us the other one. I totally cut you off, man.
I just did. It's one is container services.
Oh, you did.
The second is on scale sets. Come on.
It's like we've been married for so long. I don't even listen.
I know.
Thanks.
Speaking of not listening, we have we're going to be kicking off the show again tomorrow morning.
Of course.
If you want to come back here and join us again at 9 a.m. New Zealand time, or it's around 1 o'clock, I think it is.
Yeah, 1 p.m. Pacific time.
Yeah, you got it. If you want to go off and see that one there. And then we're going into your first interview is going to be with Chris Auld.
MVP.
Yeah. What about?
I don't know. I've heard his name. Like
You haven't done your homework?
I haven't done my homework. He's like calling me on my homework, people.
Nice.
Okay? I mean, geez.
And then we're going to have Writing the Rights. That's going to be Jess, actually.
Oh.
She's going to be talking there, otherwise known as @GirlGerms.
And she's an IT pro, right?
She's an IT pro, and she's doing a Writing the Rights, Active Directory, and Domain Security Administration and Maintenance. Mm. Rolls off the tongue. But that's going to be her first live-streamed session. I didn't even know she knows it's live-streamed.
Should we tell her?
I kind of freaked her out by just telling her that one there.
Did you say out?
The out is getting there. Then you're going to talk with Laura Bell.
Yep.
And then a Windows Devices Smackdown. Now, there's a special event going on.
Oh!
That's taking place in the other side of the hemispheres that I have no idea what's actually happening during that event.
Uh-huh.
I'm hoping that these guys are going to be able to have a bit of the glimmer of some of the new stuff coming out.
That's right. There is a Windows surprise happening the 26th, which is tomorrow in New York City.
Like
make sure you 10 a.m. Eastern Daylight Time. Make sure you tune in for that. I think they're going to be streaming that
if
as well.
If you're here in New Zealand, it's going to be around 3 a.m., so I wouldn't recommend you stay up for that one there.
Yes. And then to wrap it up, it looks like you have some interviews with Jess after her talk.
You got it. And we've got a Women in Technology lunch session taking place. You're going to be doing an interview with Nazim.
And Shweta to end up.
And I know, I think you're going to, aren't you doing a guest appearance in the Demystifying the Windows Firewall? You're going to be a guest presenter?
Oh, man. I don't know. I haven't heard.
You should drop in on that one there.
Okay, absolutely. Well, there's tons of stuff. We want to wrap up and let you know that there's, again, Thursday, full set of things happening here. You should tune in if you're an IT pro or dev. I'm sure there's lots of stuff for you to favor. Well, anything else you want to add, Mr. Rickster, CDN?
Don't forget, all the sessions for Microsoft Tonight will be available online here on channel9msdn.com. They don't tell us the SLA, if it's 24 hours, 48 hours, or longer, but it's coming soon. So in case you missed any of these sessions, you're able to go off and catch them on demand, anytime, on your mobile device or on your main device.
Thank you so much for watching, and again, we'll see you next time. Here they come.
Come on.
Take, oh, man, I'm getting workers' comp.
You got it. Look at that, I got it again.
All right. Oh.